listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. Tricia Tunstall is a writer, a teacher, and a musician, someone who cares about music and music education very, very deeply. She's the author of Note by Note, a celebration of the piano lesson, cited as an elegant, unforgettable homage to the piano lesson and the often mysterious relationship of teacher and student. Tricia maintains an active piano studio in the New York area, and she's taught music appreciation and music history at several colleges. And her new book, which we'll be talking about tonight, is Changing Lives, Gustavo Dudamel, El Sistema, and the Transformative Power of Music. It's the story of conductor extraordinaire Gustavo Dudamel. Many of you may have seen him conduct this week, and the music education program El Sistema that led to his success. Tricia Tunstall explores the lessons that he learned from El Sistema, which is a world leader in arts education, which are more than musical. And these lessons could have a far-reaching effect on how societies in the 21st century might turn situations of dead end and despair into ones of hope and promise. How do we turn inspiration about El Sistema into a reality here in the United States, especially at a time when our own city, LAUSD, proposes to cut all elementary arts education? I'm sure some of you have seen that petition go around today. To discuss that very issue, Tricia will be joined in conversation by Lenny Borston, who's the Director of Community Affairs for the Los Angeles Philharmonic Association, which is our neighbor up Grand Avenue. One of Lenny's responsibilities is the LA Phil's neighborhood concerts. Among those are the wonderful chamber music concerts that we've been able to offer for free in this very auditorium. Ms. Borston works with a consortium of organizations and individuals in support of a youth orchestra movement, YOLA, Youth Orchestra LA, in order to expand access to free, high-quality, intensive music education for underserved youth across Los Angeles. Both Lenny and Tricia have been very busy this week with the inaugural Take a Stand Symposium, sponsored by LA Phil and its two partners in a Sistema-modeled U.S. education initiative. Our host and interlocutor tonight is Brian Lauritsen, producer and host of Classical KUSC's nationwide concert broadcast of the LA Phil, as well as KUSC's weekly arts magazine, Arts Alive, and the early music program, Baroque and Beyond. Additionally, Brian writes and produces features for KUSC's more than 50 concert broadcasts each year, and I want to give a special shout-out to KUSC, which has been such a stalwart media partner for Aloud and the Library Foundation. We're very, very grateful for their support. So onwards to learning about the transformative power of music. Please welcome Tricia Tunstall, Lenny Borston, and Brian Lauritsen to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here this evening. Thank you for coming and for being here on this evening, particularly a day, as Louise mentioned, after we hear about a new proposal to eliminate arts funding in LAUSD schools. I think the conversation this evening is particularly important. So I wanted to begin actually by asking you a question, and that question is, how many of you are musicians, have had contact with musicians in your lives, like children, or studied an instrument growing up, still play an instrument? Just kind of want to see. I'm a lapsed cellist myself.
It's everybody.
So our lives are constantly touched by music. It's such a wonderful thing. And I thought we would begin our conversation this evening with a few words from Maestro José Antonio Abreu, who is the guru, I guess is a good word, right? Behind El Sistema,
the founder,
of El Sistema. Just to kind of give us a sense for the scale that this man thinks in. He is not shy. He thinks big. He dreams big. And as we'll hear tonight, he achieves big as well. I have one, and then Tricia will read a few other quotes from Jose Antonio Abreu, who says, "When arts education takes the place in our society that it deserves, we will have much less delinquency and violence and much more motivation towards noble achievement. My struggle is for a society in which art is not just an aesthetic dimension of life, it is a primary instrument for the development of individuals and societies." That's vintage Jose Antonio Abreu. That's the scope of his thinking, his dreaming for El Sistema. Tricia has a few quotes as well to share.
There were so many quotes to choose from. It was very hard to winnow them down. I could have written basically the whole book. It could have been this much of just quotes from Antonio Abreu. So I had to choose, and they are very rich. Here are a couple of the ones I chose. "The orchestra and the choir are much more than artistic studies. They are examples and schools of social life. From the minute a child is taught how to play an instrument, he is no longer poor. He becomes a child in progress who will become a citizen." And here's one more beautiful one before we continue. "Poverty is not just the lack of a roof or bread. It is also a spiritual lack, a loneliness and a lack of recognition. The vicious cycle of poverty can be broken when a child, poor in material possessions, acquires spiritual wealth through music."
So the stakes are high, and the solution to many of the problems of in poverty, in crime, in violence, in the youth of Venezuela, the solution is, it's so amazing because it begins with music, which may seem counterintuitive to someone who's not used to thinking that way, right?
Right. Well, I think most of us are not used to thinking that way, even those of us who are music educators, even professional musicians or music lovers, as you all are. I think we're not used to thinking about music in terms of social change. We all know that music can affect one very powerfully individually. And certainly as a piano teacher, I've seen children profoundly changed by the experience of studying music. But this grander vision, the idea that music can actually, let me put it more precisely, the experience of playing music in orchestral ensemble in an intense, very intense sort of daily situation, that experience can actually disrupt the cycle of poverty. I think that, and that's a new thought. It certainly was to me.
What does the orchestral model, and this is, I guess, to both of you, Lenny and Tricia, what does the orchestral model teach us about community?
As a start, Antonio Abreu uses it as a metaphor for community.
Right.
You have to listen to others. It is a place where you come together to play well with others. You bring yourself, you bring your individual practice, in a sense, but you bring it in service to listening to others and playing ensemble. And on top of that, he has not started a program where kids are working as individuals in a practice room, which is what most of our... How many of you, you know, worked in practice rooms all that time that you were playing instruments by yourself?
Yes.
So for some of us, that's what turned us off to becoming, realizing one could not become a professional musician without that, and going, I'm too social to be alone in that practice room. So one of the recognitions of Dr. Abreu was, let's do this in group. Let's immediately play together. Why isolate kids from that? Why not teach a sense of community and responsibility to it across an ensemble and with an orchestra?
And I think the one other dimension to it that is almost goes without saying, is very intuitive, is that when you're in that community, you're also inside of beauty. That the goal of that community is not to go out and, for example, beat another team on a soccer field, or, you know, there are many kinds of teamwork, but often they're competitive in nature, or certainly not aesthetic in nature. But the goal of an orchestra is to create beauty. And so when you're, the whole time you're doing that and forming the relationships that Lenny's talking about, you're also inside something beautiful.
You mentioned some sort of, I guess alarming would be the word, statistics about hours spent per year in the United States with music education. Here in the United States, it's 46 hours on average per year for the, I guess that's elementary school or high school.
I think that's all-encompassing.
All,
yeah.
Places like Japan and Finland, you say, are around 300 hours per year.
So, in school education, right.
So the deficit is great.
And becoming greater. It sounds like this morning it became greater.
Right. I mean, so we've never really had enough in LAUSD recently, but now if it gets cut back, it's not one music teacher for a school of 800. It's no music teachers and no visual arts teachers. So it would be best, in the best of all possible worlds, there would be music during the school day and arts education in the school day for every child. So we are starting at quite a deficit when you think of social justice and having equal access to a quality education and the fundamentals that we believe in for education. We're starting somewhere quite other at the moment.
Well, and there's a great paradox, too, between the folks who probably need this music and arts education in their lives, or there are these this great inequity between racial classes, races and classes, mm-hmm. In society here in the United States. The folks that need it the most are the ones who are the most underserved.
I think that's true. I think that middle class and wealthier kids and families, they have access to private music lessons, they have access to better schools, private schools, they have all kinds of access that underserved kids just don't have and families don't have and can't have. So that's definitely, I think, why the Sistema targets this. It sort of goes without saying that everybody can benefit and thrive with a full, complete music and arts education. But I think the reason the Sistema really concentrates on that underserved class is that if it doesn't, it won't be there. It won't happen.
So Changing Lives by Tricia Tunstall tells the story of El Sistema and how it grew from, I'll let you tell the story, but how it grew from nothing. it's an incredible chronicle of a story that I think we've all sort of heard bits and pieces of, right? If we've seen the 60 Minutes, or one of the several 60 Minutes features on Gustavo Dudamel, on Yola, on El Sistema, I think we know bits and pieces of that story. Here, it's all in one place.
I hope.
She didn't pay me for that endorsement. but it's fabulous. I mean, this is a story that we know a little bit about, I think, especially here in Los Angeles. But I wonder if you could take us to the beginning.
I would love to.
El Sistema.
It's really my favorite story. When I realized that I had to write this book several years ago, and I first heard about the Sistema, about Gustavo, and I really felt, and I realized that there was no book about it, and there needed to be. Very shortly after I started to write the book, I realized that it's not one story, it's a number of stories. So the book really comprises the story of the beginning in Venezuela, the spread, and also all of the beginnings and expansions here. But I think that maybe my favorite of all the wonderful stories is the very story of its beginning. And it begins with what I found when I went to Venezuela and visited Núcleos and talked to teachers and children and administrators, I really found that all roads led to José Antonio Abreu. They all could quote him. They all knew who he was. They spoke of his vision with a kind of clarity and personal understanding that was really remarkable. So I realized I had to go to the source. And I did, and had a wonderful interview with him in which he described to me growing up in Barquisimeto. Well, I don't want to give away all the story, but I'll give away some of it. When he was growing up in a city, in the central plains of Venezuela called Barquisimeto, also where Gustavo Dudamel is from, not so coincidentally, he studied piano with a remarkable woman named Doralisa de Medina. her practice, unlike any piano teacher I've ever seen or heard of, was to have a number of pianos in, I guess, a large room or a courtyard, and to teach several students at once. So he began studying piano that way. He also studied violin when he was coming, and then he came to Caracas as a young conservatory student and was shocked at the isolation that a music student faced in pursuing a career in music. He did pursue that career, got a degree, also got a degree in economics, but realized when he graduated that there was very little chance for him to play anywhere. There were no orchestras where Venezuelan musicians were employed. There were a few orchestras, one in Caracas, one in another city, but they were all pretty much made up of foreigners. And so there was really nowhere for a young Venezuelan musician to play, and he was very upset by this and decided to do something about it. So he marshaled some music stands. Now, this is the part of the story that many of you have heard because it's very... it's sort of the signature creation myth, if you will, of the Sistema.
It's very Silicon Valley, right?
It's very Silicon Valley. And so one of the things I wanted to do when I met with him was to figure out, did this really happen? You know, and in fact, it did. And I'd like now to read you, in his own words, what happened at that point. He called together all the young musicians that he knew, put out the word, and said, got an abandoned parking garage, got some music stands, got some music, and said, come and play. And, says Abreu, I called many music students to come to rehearsal in the garage, but only 11 showed up. It was a disheartening prospect, and I knew that this was a moment of truth. Either something momentous had to happen, or it was over. And I said this to the 11 students. I told them that this could be a historic moment, and I asked them to come with me on this journey. 25 young music students came the next day. The day after that, there were 46. We recruited students from music schools in Caracas, which did not have orchestras. Some came with their own instruments. Others who did not have instruments came with borrowed ones. And within a month, we had 75 young musicians. So what he had at that point was an orchestra, in fact. An orchestra with no funding, an orchestra with no rehearsal space, with no prospects of playing, and with some musicians who were actually not very good. Here he is with this vision of a great orchestra and this reality that's very far away from that. And I asked him, how did he do it? Because within months, this orchestra was playing successfully, professionally. And he said there were really two great principles that he had learned from that piano teacher in Venezuela that he used. One was the idea of peer teaching, of learning in a group. He had he sat the students who were better next to the students who were less good. He had the orchestra constantly interacting and teaching and learning from one another. That was vital. It couldn't have happened otherwise. And he imbued them all with the spirit of, this is how it should be. This is how you build an orchestra. And the second great principle that he used was the importance of performance. Evidently, Dora Lisa had her students performing pretty much every week. He said, we performed because it was somebody's birthday, or because it was Friday, or because it was raining. We just performed. So he brought that principle to bear and immediately started scheduling performances for this young orchestra, who then had to practice like crazy in their, you know, a parking garage with their borrowed instrument to sound good enough. And within 4 months, they had their first public performance. And within a year, less than a year, they had their first international appearance in Mexico. And the orchestra kept growing, acquiring new musicians from all over Venezuela as people heard about this and came to join this amazing endeavor. So I'd like to read you one more quote about that process of expansion. I asked, and this is a quote not from Abreu, but from David Ascanio, who was one of the founding members who worked very closely with Abreu during those founding years, as did many passionate musicians who couldn't say no to him, which is pretty much everyone he talked to. So I asked David whether Abreu auditioned the players before inviting them to join. No, 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 David responds. No auditions, no questions, nothing. If you wanted to play, you were welcome. You play violin? Okay, here's your chair. Sit here, he would say. It didn't matter how much or how little you knew, because part of joining the orchestra was teaching the others and learning from the others. One of the maestro's fundamental ideas has always been that if you know nothing but A, B, and C, you have the power to teach A, B, and C, and not only the power, but the responsibility. And not only that, you will learn yourself by teaching, and you will break through to D, E, and F. So people came, and word spread. They came from the music schools of Caracas, from the mountains of Trujillo and the plains of Barquisimeto, from the countryside and the seacoast. Many were still in their teens. Some had never been away from home before. Sound, says David. More than anything else, Jose Abreu was obsessed with working on the beauty of the sound. In rehearsals, he would say, I want this sound. And they would play that passage over and over again. What really kept all of us there, I wonder, he says, it was not the promise of a better musical career. It was certainly not in that moment a promise of a scholarship or a grant, and it was certainly not the idea of creating a huge sistema. It was the opportunity for each of us really to make music together in capital letters in the highest possible way. From Abreu's energy, we could feel the message behind the music, the spiritual fountain from which it comes, and that was really what it was about for us, to serve that spirit as we could in that moment. That is what kept us in the orchestra. So I wanted to give you that little snapshot of the orchestra at its beginning, because you can see that that original vision, as it grew, evolved somewhat. As Abreu saw people joining his orchestra, people practicing like crazy, and the orchestra really becoming an entity, he saw something that he hadn't quite realized in the beginning, which was that they were being changed by this experience. And many of them came from modest families. Some of them came to Caracas with no money to go back, just with a one-way fare. He saw that they were actually being changed into a different sort of more confident, more capable people, more generous, more responsible. And he saw that the families and the communities were being affected in that way. And it was then, as the orchestra grew and as he perceived these things, that his vision of music education as social transformation was really born. That was the crucible, and it grew from there.
And one of the things that we've talked about is, this idea that there is a social justice aspect to music. And one of Jose Antonio Abreu's genius moves, I think, was approaching when he as the orchestra was becoming more and more popular around the world, the Venezuelan government takes notice, and Abreu approaches the government, not, though, as you say, the Ministry of Culture. Instead, he approaches...
Great leader.
Segue, good.
Great segue. Not that, this was in the very beginning he knew this. Did not want help from the Ministry of Culture. He wanted to be under the auspices of the Ministry of Youth Development. And he said, because if it was an arts program, the next administration would take it away. How well he knew. Something we all have learned time and time again. And so, but calling it youth development, calling it a social service, calling it really and something important for the children and youth of the nation, that allowed him to make a powerful case for it, even as administrations changed from centrist to rightist to leftist. That piece stayed in place. It was amazing.
Amazing stability, for sure, over the years in Venezuela. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the climate today in the neighborhoods, in the barrios, where so many of these kids are coming from. Venezuela, a country of 28 million. The poverty rate is something astonishing, like 70% to 80%. In Caracas, the capital, as you know, there's enormous oil wealth side by side. Literally, you can see the photos, the aerial photos. You can see the dividing line of wealth versus poverty in the barrios that creep up the hillsides, literally on top of one another. And yet, in those barrios, there are these núcleos, 300 or so of them, across the country of Venezuela, serving 370,000 kids each year.
It's extraordinary. It's true that it's a country of great extremes between wealth and poverty. It's hard to describe, but it is a wonderful, sort of an extraordinary thing, something that I had never experienced before, of being in poverty, in a real barrio neighborhood where there were, you know, stray dogs in the streets and barbed wire and broken windows. And there would be this one building where music would be coming out, you know, just amazing, Mozart, Vivaldi, and it was often a building that was used for, had another purpose. I mean, this is how Abreu did it. He would find a building that had some space in the afternoons. Maybe it was a school in the mornings. Maybe it was, there's one, the big one at a racetrack that's not used in the afternoons. He's found spaces and he populates them with wonderful dedicated teachers and instruments, and children come. And they play. There are usually in these nucleares, there are not one but several orchestras according to level, roughly. There's the lower, even the little children are playing in an orchestra, and then there's a middle orchestra that they graduate to when they're ready, and then there's the youth orchestra that they graduate to. So children can really stay in these programs from very small, two or three, to when they graduate from high school. So it sees them through that period of childhood, that especially the preteen and the teen years, which can be so deadly, perilous in those barrios.
Is the model of El Sistema, José Antonio Abreu attacking poverty? Is this part of this? Certainly, is part of his fight. But he talks about poverty as being more than just economic poverty, right?
He does, and that's part of what I read in the first quote, is he talks about it as being spiritual poverty. He sees poverty as not only a lack of material things, he sees it as a real degradation, that it can really lead to degradation of the spirit, hopelessness, despair. And it's that level that he's addressing. I mean, for us in the United States, it's kind of a leap of the imagination to think music, poverty, and he's never claimed that he can end poverty, that his program can end poverty, ever. What he does claim is that the children in his program can perhaps, hopefully, come to a different understanding of themselves and a different relation to society so that they can go out in the world equipped to become something better and to leave their situation and to bring their families with them often. So it's an emotional, spiritual, psychological way of saving people and bringing them out of poverty. Mm-hmm.
So this El Sistema began in 1976. It's been functioning ever since. It really only came to public consciousness outside of a few select musical circles just several years ago. And it, for me, as I think for so many other Americans at least, our first introduction to El Sistema was the Mambo video, right? On YouTube, 2007, the BBC Proms, Gustavo Dudamel conducting, then they were known as the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra, now they're the Symphony Orchestra, dancing, spinning their trumpets to probably the most raucous British audience in history.
Right.
and this was our introduction to what was going on in Venezuela. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like people here in the United States, elsewhere in Europe, got inspired.
Yes, but that's true. But I think we have to say that some of the first inspiration came right here.
Yes.
This was when the LA Phil, and I'm going to turn this over to you, sure. When the LA Phil was in the process of looking for a successor, a conductor, that could succeed the current one, and the Simón Bolívar's played, right? Did they come in 2007?
They came in 2007, but I think the video was going viral before that, and I
yes.
just want to mention something in this as well as what we saw in that, and what was so astounding in that video is how much fun people
right.
were having playing music, and I think that was what was so revelatory.
Yes.
Because we are so used to our orchestras and our musicians not looking so happy when they play.
True.
And to see people playing with such exuberance was just, it took your breath away, and it just got everybody thinking, and of course it went viral in
right.
that way. So at the same time, yes, we're looking for a new music director, and you know, in 2006, and Gustavo had won the conducting competition and been brought to the attention of Essa Pekka and Ernest Fleischman, and by the next summer, you know, he came and conducted at the Hollywood Bowl. I think that was summer of 2005.
Five, right.
So he made his debut, and it was breathtaking for people who were there to hear this young conductor, all of 20-something, six, five, conducting the LA Philharmonic. And again, you kind of went to the edge of your seat at the Hollywood Bowl with the LA Philharmonic because it was, I think it was Tchaikovsky Five, if I remember. I'm surprised I can remember. But it was something that everybody took note of. And Deborah then, yes, in her search, you know, the job of an executive director or president of a symphony orchestra, as soon as you have one music director, is to begin thinking about succession. I hope she's not thinking about that too soon, right? Now.
Contract is through 2018, yes. 2019.
But she was looking and then went on the hunt for Dudamel and started following him around wherever he was conducting, and as she says, not very glamorous locations sometimes. Right. And somewhere in that search, she realized, I need to find out what his roots are. And so a small troop of Philharmonic folks, including our education director at the time and our director of artistic planning, went to Venezuela to see him in action there, and then discovered for themselves El Sistema and visited the Nucleos, which are, you know, another name for community music school, perhaps, if we're not familiar with it. And it changed their lives. At that time, when people were going to Venezuela and coming back, they came back and their jaws literally were dropped and their eyes looked kind of glazed, and they kept talking about what they saw, and you had to go down there, and we had to do something about it. And if we have so much here in the United States, as Dr. Abreu says, why can't we do it here? Why not here? If you could do it in Venezuela, why not here?
Right.
And Deborah, you know, while in pursuit of Gustavo, also felt that whatever happens with that, because as she was saying, other people took note of Gustavo too. It's not exactly, he's not at that point, living
under a rock.
Right. And so other orchestras were pursuing him too. But she made a commitment, and with our board, and we made lots of presentations to our board about establishing an El Sistema related or inspired program in the United States in Los Angeles, whether or not Dudamel came. And we did. And we began, I think, even before he was named our music director, which happened in April of 2007, if I have it right. In 2006, we knew that the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra, as you say, at the time, was coming and touring to Los Angeles. And in preparation for that, we also knew, because of 60 Minutes, because of the Mambo, we would get an extraordinary attention. Los Angeles would get enormous attention for that visit and for the performances, and they would be electrified, we imagined. And we wanted to make the best of it and make the most of it for music education, for understanding what it might mean in Los Angeles, and to share the light. And that's when we started bringing people who are already engaged in music education, after school, during school, LA's Best, Beyond the Bell, all whomever had some inkling of this might mean something to them. We kind of met together, and with people from the city as well, to see what that might mean so we could take advantage of it. And that's when we planned kind of a first symposium or conference around it, because again, we knew it would be miraculous. We were having the Simón Bolívar here as part of an international youth orchestra festival. And so we were comparing the Finnish education system and also the after-school movement, and Eric Booth, who's in the audience, led that particular conference for us. We had people from Jeff Carr, who preceded the current mayor's office for gang reduction and youth development, and some people from after school, and they also were making promises for what they could offer to what we might do in Los Angeles. And we announced that we would get it started at that point. And we couldn't do it alone. That's the other thing we recognized. We're not Venezuela. The LA Philharmonic is not everything. There are other organizations in LA that are working in schools after school with young musicians in underserved areas. And we partnered with the Harmony Project. And we worked with the City of Los Angeles and the Recreation and Parks Department to work together to establish this program
at the Expo Center, which is in South LA, just south of USC and the Coliseum, in the shadow of the Coliseum, actually.
And at what point did you put the first instrument in a child's hand?
It's a very good question, because we might do it. We actually do it differently now than we did then.
Okay.
We put the instruments went in kids' hands right away, as a start, but we didn't know all the tools and nature of what was possible in El Sistema. So what we drew from is, we knew that when Gustavo would be back in LA 9 months later, that he would have to have an ensemble of musicians, young musicians, to rehearse or work with. But we didn't know how to do that from day one, as they did in Venezuela. This first time with our first site, we were working with Harmony Project. We did group lessons, and so kids played first with instruments in their hands, but in group lessons, not entirely in ensemble at first. They didn't know the first note, much less three notes. So we began at a different beginning where kids did have instruments in their hands, and we had group lessons, and we brought them together as an ensemble the following summer. We started in the fall, and that summer is when we began playing together as an orchestra.
So 2007, Gustavo Dudamel is announced as the next mm-hmm. music director of the LA Philharmonic in something I've never seen before in my life or heard of in all of time, you know, one music director literally passing the baton to
literally.
The next
right.
On stage together at Walt Disney Concert Hall. But his tenure doesn't start until 2009, the 9-10 season. Mm-hmm. What was his involvement in the early stages of YOLA?
He went and rehearsed the kids in the next fall, and I'll be corrected, I hope, by my comrade in action, or my colleague, Gretchen Nielsen, the director of educational initiatives at the Philharmonic, but I think the next fall of 08, he conducted the first rehearsal, not of the ensemble, but his presence there. Then he conducted the kids for the first time at the Expo Center. And an Ode to Joy was one of the things he was working on, and we have a small video of that probably on our website still. And you hear the beginnings of the kids playing, and one of the things he said to them, which is another feature of what Dr. Abreu would do with young musicians in Venezuela, was say, next time I rehearse with you, it will be on the stage of Walt Disney Concert Hall. So he sets these bars, and all of a sudden everybody's looking around, okay, when's that going to be? What's he say? You sit up and take notice as the administrators, and kind of, how do we make that happen? Well, the fact is we didn't make that happen next. The next time that he conducted this orchestra was when he became music director in October of 2009. And so the first time he next conducted the kids was not on the stage of Walt Disney Concert Hall. It was on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl. And I remember one of the little videos on there, you know, they had a preparatory video, and when one of the girls who's in the orchestra saying, yeah, and we're going to be playing for 1,800 kids, people out in the audience, and the heading on there goes, she doesn't know it's 18,000 people. But you know, that was that symbolism was quite amazing, which was that the first downbeat of conducting the orchestra once Dudamel had been named the music director of the LA Philharmonic was not of the LA Philharmonic, but was of the Expo Center Youth Orchestra.
What a great symbol for his tenure, mm-hmm. really, that he was involved in this project even prior to being the music director of this orchestra, that the downbeat, as you say, mm-hmm. was his first official downbeat was not with the LA Philharmonic, but with these kids. Mm-hmm. I love the fact, and as a classical arts journalist, I see him bouncing around town, and the LA Phil has been gracious enough to invite some of us to some of these events where he conducts. But I actually like the fact that Gustavo goes to rehearse with these kids, and people like me don't know about it. Like, it's not a big press release. It's not a big publicity thing. There are cameras following him literally around everywhere. When we do live broadcasts, you know, there's like two or three or four camera crews following him around. But he manages to make education such an important part of what he does, not just as LA Philharmonic music director, but just as a human being, mm-hmm. that he will quietly slip away to go work with these kids. No cameras, no writers, no radio people sticking a microphone in his face. None of that. It's all so incredibly, wonderfully genuine.
Well, I agree. We also have Dudamel fellows who are the conductor, a team of conductors, some of whom come from Venezuela and they come from around the world, but they also quietly go and work at our YOLA sites to work with the kids. And it was, it wasn't Dudamel who conducted this big concert we had last Monday at the cathedral, which we'll see a clip in a minute of the Brahms Hungarian Dance number 5 that he does rehearse with them, but he wasn't conducting at the cathedral. It was Joshua Dos Santos, with whom, who has grown up through El Sistema, yes, but it wasn't Dudamel. And also our YOLA conductor, Bruce Kiesling, also conducted them. He wasn't there. Yes, the Simon Bolivars were there, but it wasn't Dudamel. So yes, it is something of deep commitment and not just about cameras falling around.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a camera at the rehearsal,
yes.
In October, I think, mm-hmm. And we actually have a video clip of Gustavo Dudamel rehearsing with some of these kids from YOLA.
And before we get, I want to say the kids that you'll see in the video are from the Expo Center, and they represent the third orchestra that we have there. We have a beginning orchestra, we have a middle orchestra, and we have the chamber orchestra. The chamber orchestra that is in this video spent a week together, a summer intensive week at Colburn, working in a way they hadn't worked before, because they are again in the spirit of El Sistema. They are the leaders, they are the mentors, they have responsibilities for the program beyond their playing an instrument well within the context of the ensemble. They are leading classes with kids who are younger than they or less experienced than they, and you just see them flourishing in that way. The orchestra, so the chamber orchestra that is rehearsing with Dudamel in our choral hall, have been practicing through all this time, and then they just played at the cathedral, but not again by themselves. There are a couple other layers of mentoring that was going on. The orchestra that performed at the cathedral included the brass and wind ensembles, or the musicians from our other site at OLA. And I want to just take a moment to describe them, which is kind of a detour for a second. But when we started our second site, we could do it differently from what we were learning in the interim. We learned a lot with what we learned at Expo Center. We were learning more about what was going on in Venezuela. There were the Abrero Fellows from the New England Conservatory of Music, who were like the designated learners about the program and bringing it as they spread it around the country. Two of whom were working with us as our YOLA manager, and one who's managing the site, the YOLA program at OLA, Heart of LA, which is at Wilshire and Lafayette Park Place in the Rampart District of LA. And there we started differently, and I detour just to mention it, though these are not the kids you're seeing in the video. We started with first graders and fourth graders. Now, if you think back to first grade, you can play a string instrument because you can hold it and learn to hold it, and there's a whole paper orchestra program, which means that you put a different instrument in the kid's hands, not the violin, but a paper violin or a cardboard violin that they make and learn to care for before you have the exchange. But first graders don't have any front teeth. They can't play brass instruments, and they can't play wind instruments.
I never thought of that.
So we have first grade violinists, but fourth grade wind and brass players, mm-hmm. at OLA. So we started differently. So year 2, which is what we are in with OLA, YOLA at OLA, you have first and second graders playing violins, and then fourth and fifth graders playing winds and brass. So at the concert that was a culmination from this rehearsal and beyond, you have kids also then from OLA playing at the cathedral who are playing brass and wind instruments because they're older. They've excelled so fast with the intensity of the program that they too were part of the community concert that happened that these kids are also rehearsing for. Okay, So, set this up. In October of this year, you know, Gustavo Dudamel was in town conducting the LA Philharmonic. We knew that we were aiming for this joint visit with the Simón Bolívar's, and so you will hear the way in which Gustavo conducts young people, and you will have an idea of how he conducts and rehearses the LA Philharmonic as you watch him prepare these young musicians.
So I was listening to Brahms, and was amazing. I feel really proud. You can do more contrast, you know. It's like art. It's like being an artist, and every person in the party is different. Let's play a little bit that. My English is not there. I will sit a little bit. I'm an old generation conductor. But, that's right. Okay? I will try to follow your tempo at the beginning. Love, what a beautiful love, war.
us the love that we have. Please, can you bam, 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 together, okay? I love this music.
30. So that's Gustavo Dudamel in action at his finest. As an Angeleno, I'm very proud of what is happening here in our city and what the LA Philharmonic is doing. And I want to give you a chance to ask some questions of both Lenny and Tricia. But quickly, first, LA is not the only place here in the United States where we have exciting things like this happening. Talk a little bit about some of the El Sistema-inspired programs around the United States.
Well, LA is certainly one of the first and the most developed. I would even call it the sort of flagship in a way, because of how developed and how big and how evolved it is. But there are many other. There are, at last count, I think,
55. We were told at the symposium, weren't counting all of them yet.
Well, and I always have the feeling when I cite this statistic that as I'm sitting here saying 55, there's someone, in Nebraska starting one and just making my figure invalid even as I give it. So they have, just in the last few years, they have really just exploded all over the country. And I think the reasons for that are partly the visibility of Gustavo at the LA Phil, the viral YouTube, and also Abreu receiving the TED Prize, which is a big event. TED, along with its prize, gives each winner the chance to make a speech and make a wish. And Abreu's speech, which you can also find on YouTube, was so amazingly eloquent. He made it in Spanish, but it's got subtitles, and it was just such a passion. Well, you heard some of his words. The whole speech was just that eloquent and just that inspired. And so that video has kind of gone viral. And at the end, he made his wish that we would establish a program where 10 gifted young musicians passionate for their art and for social justice would be trained every year for the next 5 years. And so the New England Conservatory was the one who took up that program. But even before that, there were some real pioneers. There was a Nucleo established in New York very early on, I think right after yours, one in Baltimore, one in San Antonio. Those were the early sort of pioneers. And then after the first class of Abreu Fellows, then that even accelerated the pace. So there are Nucleos really, I think, probably in many, many states of this country, and they are growing like wildfire. It's amazing. And this symposium that we just finished was eloquent testimony to how passionately interested people are in this. There were people from 27 states there and 15
countries.
Again, these figures just keep running away from us.
Mm-hmm. It's like the number of Nucleos in El Sistema. We don't really know.
Yeah.
Somewhere around 300. Yeah.
We're taking that lesson too,
right,
just to be imprecise,
yes,
with our group.
Right, exactly. But that is one of the things that I think for me is the most inspiring about the programs that are popping up here in the United States, is that it truly is a grassroots effort.
Yes.
And I think that really is something that's going to lend it some tremendous staying power.
Yes. And in Changing Lives, I sort of hone in on four programs: Los Angeles, Baltimore, San Antonio, and New York, and describe them in a little bit of detail, because one of the beautiful things about this is that you can apply the principles of El Sistema very effectively and still meet the needs of your particular community. And so it shows up a little bit differently in every place that it takes root. And I found that one of the beauties of it, one of the really interesting things about it. So it's kind of there's infinite possibility in it. Not a formula. It's a vision, but it's not a formula.
The other thing we would want to mention in that context is there are efforts that have become related, but
yes,
began independently and before we were aware of all that El Sistema might be or we can learn from. In LA, the Renaissance Arts Academy is a charter school with music infused into the curriculum itself, and where kids go there by lottery, not by audition. And the achievement and the depth of understanding of music and life of the kids at that middle and high school in Eagle Rock is extraordinary. And I think in Chicago, based on settlement music, yes, school sort of thing patterns, they've been decades
and
old programs.
Providence, there's an amazing
right. So the community
program.
Music works. So there are so many different ways of looking at this, but there's something about El Sistema that's catalyzed our thinking about it because the potential just is so robust, so rich, and is so inspiring to people in different ways, or taps into something that we may have experienced when we were young and go. And didn't know how to make it, express
right.
it. And El Sistema has brought that to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
So we can be alarmist and we can talk about funding cuts, or we can realize that the future is quite bright, actually. There will be microphones. There are microphones circulating. Before we begin the question and answer session, though, I just want to say really briefly that... if you enjoy these programs here at the Central Library, they only exist with your support. And if you have been thinking about becoming a member of the Library Foundation, I would highly, highly encourage that. They don't receive any city funding. They function on kind of like public radio, listener and member support. I think the entry-level membership is something like $50 for the year, $85 for 2 years. So highly, highly recommend it. And before I switch into public radio pledge drive mode, I will ask if there are any questions.
Next to Bolivia is Letty that we're talking
about.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I didn't expect that. My question is more socioeconomic in terms of the children who participate. Are they children who come from an environment where they have access to their own transportation? Do they have the support of family, two parents? The family involvement, where's that support from outside that allows them to come the first time and then keep coming?
Are you talking about in Venezuela or here?
Here in L.A.
Here in L.A.
In L.A., the community programs are in communities where we've established them where there's some public transportation around Expo Center. We focus on kids who are within 5 mile radius. And at Expo Center, there are some kids who walk. There are kids who come from school in vans. There are kids whose parents, grandparents, siblings get them there. And one thing we haven't emphasized so much is this does involve the family in that way. And what you see very quickly is how you can't have this kind of intensive program without the families taking part, because they're getting their kids to this program for 3 hours every day after school and on Saturdays. So we now have at Expo Center, and there are kids who have been in this program, and their younger siblings are in the program, and their younger siblings will soon be in the program. And the toddlers come to the program with their parents. I mean, there's a long swath of involvement that happens there. At Ola, it's slightly different because that's probably one of the densest part of Los Angeles, and the families come from 1 or 2 miles around, and there are many fewer cars owned by the families around Ola, Heart of LA, who's our partner in providing Yola at Ola. So I hope that answers a little bit.
I have one question for each of you. I was wondering if you could tell us or compare and contrast the Finnish program with El Sistema. And I was wondering if you could tell us how many people are actually in Yola and how many could be if you had the facilities and the space and the money.
Well, the potential. I'll start with the second and let you work on with the Finnish model. We have 500 kids in the program now, about 320 at Expo Center from age 2, a preschool program, to 17, and about 180 at Heart of LA. The potential for growth within the centers are capped by what you've already noticed or mentioned is physical space. Expo Center is bursting at the seams. Those classes and the ensembles work at the Expo Center, the swim stadium itself, the senior center, and the preschool. There, you kind of run around from different places on the at Expo Center, which used to be called the intergenerational center, because the senior center to preschool and everything in between. At OLA, we have room for growth, but they're looking at finding another building. We at the Philharmonic are expecting and committed to finding a third site, but space is key. It's hard to find a partner who manages sufficient space that they can dedicate to it, or sufficient space at all. And we want it in neighborhoods where, again, to the other gentleman's point, where families, where there's either good transportation or walking distance, or a density that makes it easy to happen in the particular community. So yeah, if we had endless money, we certainly would expand it. But we are finding the space that's actively managed by a partner who can take this on with us in partnership is not quite as easy as you'd like to think. Other programs in LA, though, we're not the only people doing this. Verdugo Young Musicians Association, it has a program within the Longfellow Elementary School in Pasadena. And whatever you may think of the demographics of Pasadena in the public schools, it is not the same as what you're thinking of. And then Harmony Project, who is our partner at Expo Center, has other programs in other places. So we're reaching 500 kids. Harmony Project's reaching another 1,000 kids. At Longfellow, there are a couple of hundred kids.
A couple hundred, yeah.
So the numbers are still very modest in what the potential is. But I want to go back for one moment to say that we can't... For the social justice aspect of this and complete democratization, the public schools have to take on more than they are. There are 700,000 simply elementary school kids in LAUSD. So when I mention numbers as modest as 500 or 1,000 or 1,500 or 6,000 nationwide, you can think of that as a large number or a very tiny number. And think of all the kids who are in our public schools in underserved areas. Sorry.
My answer is much shorter than that, because I'm really not qualified to talk about the Finnish school system. I don't know very much about a music system. I don't know much about it except to say that it is an in-school situation, that music education in Finland does happen in an abundant way, and it's in schools, and it's part of the central curriculum. So it's really valued that way. Mm-hmm. More than that, I don't know. When I was writing the book, I was really tempted to go to every country I could see a sistema possibly arising in, but I just couldn't. So I limited the book to Venezuela and the United States. And I'd like to add one thing to what Lenny said about Pasadena, because thanks to the LA, to the wide stakeholder net that you have, that you've established, I think this is kind of the hotbed. This Southern California area is sort of the hotbed of El Sistema USA. There's this thriving program in Pasadena. There's a thriving program in San Diego, and another one in Santa Barbara, which, again, no matter what you think of the demographic, it's not that. It's different. Mm-hmm. So these programs have started in the last few years, just the last couple of years, but they're very robust, and in fact, they're so robust already that they planned a joint concert, an all-day joint workshop and concert that they call, after the Venezuelan fashion, a seminario, which took place today. And I spent all day in Pasadena watching this amazing thing happen, with hundreds of children arriving on buses and from all different directions and filling up, the courtyards and the auditorium and their parents. Lots of parents came. And talk to just to your point about family support. These families came, the 90 minutes from Santa Barbara and the several hours from San Diego, and put on an event that was so spectacular, so brimming with the kind of sistema spirit of mutual learning and joy in the music. And guess what they played? What did they play? They played the Ode to Joy. Really, a lot of them played and sang, and the parents played recorder. It was amazing.
I find this all very exciting since I grew up and learned the violin 10 years at the music school settlement in Manhattan and traveled by subway from Brooklyn. I'm wondering, though, how the programs, both here and the other four cities, the three cities you mentioned, are being supported and funded. Do the children pay a fee for their lessons? Who pays for the teachers? Mm-hmm. How, is this going to be able to continue if there is no funding?
We ought to start to say it is not through the school systems, and it is free to the children. The whole point of it is to provide free access to the instruments, instrumental instruction, and then the ensemble work for the children who are involved. And it's funded, you know, with the LA Philharmonic through our contributors. You know, we have a long list of contributors, so it's individuals and foundations and who fund these programs.
City that where it's established, there's a different sort of coalition of funding that's put together. It really depends on the site, and it's a struggle. Each of these programs is really struggling to figure out a combination of foundations, private donors, local municipal support, all kinds of sort of to kind of patch together enough funding to make these programs happen. So sustainability and funding is a constant preoccupation mm-hmm. of these programs.
And we, you know, I think one of the early things, again, about Venezuela, and I guess I had it a little wrong, although I'm not sure, which was that in Venezuela, that not funded through, you know, the arts, not, you know, an arts department or a ministry of arts and culture, not funded through education,
right.
But I had always said through the health department. Now, I don't know if the youth development is under a health ministry, but that was what I always had. That's what I'd heard it was earlier.
Well,
on.
It might have been at one point. As the administrations changed, though, some of those labels
moving around, moving around.
Changed.
But so that was something that we brought back and kind of opened people's eyes to what the potential was and what it was about. It's, you know, about youth development. It's about healthy communities. So is there potential as we move forward in the United States to find other funding sources that recognize that it is not simply a music education program. It is about healthy communities, and it is about youth development and family health. You can help us in that. But in the meantime, we all have to make sure that LAUSD funds the arts education programs first. That's tomorrow. We'll work on the longer range issues after that.
Hi, yes. I work with a lot of schools in Compton, Inglewood, Watts. Students ranging from middle school to high school, a continuation school. And I have witnessed the power of music at some very emotionally tense, you know, junctures, like a fight erupted or... and actually witnessed that the people who are in the music program, they behave differently compared to probably those who were not exposed. So I'm just wondering, is the program active in these areas or in these vicinities, Compton, Inglewood, Watts?
The place right now where there is a very active program is at the Watts Willowbrook Boys and Girls Club. Les Jones, who is the executive director, has very committed to the music program there, and he talks about issues that are different than the ones we face at Expo Center because his kids can't walk across the street from their school to get to the community center. So some of their program, I think he mentioned something like 23 active gangs in the area. So the Boys and Girls Club has some of the music learning on school campuses, and then they come together once a week for the ensemble work at the Watts Willowbrook Boys and Girls Club. So that's the closest that I can think of at the moment.
Well, this is kind of a challenge. I'm here from Alaska. Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates for teens in the nation. We're a broad state. We have maybe 750,000 people total. They're trying to figure out how to cut the number of suicides down. We have a big international population in Anchorage, so I don't know much about that. Many of the suicides are Alaska Native. And And in villages that are connected only by air or water in the summer, is there any way that a place with, you know, 100 to 300 kids, could you see something like this working? And, you know, it's all started since I've come to the Mahler Project and heard the kids play and got your book and I've been reading it, and it just seems to me that there is a possibility here, but...
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a huge possibility that is exactly what the Sistema is about. Situations that are that radical in terms of the hopelessness and despair that arise in cultures, that in situations like that. There is, I want to tell you, a really wonderful El Sistema site in Juneau, Alaska. It's run by one of the first class of the Abreu Fellows. So it's about 3 years old now. Her name is Laurie Hagee, and she's absolutely a wonderful educator. And the program in Juneau is called JAMM, I think, J-A-M-M. Juneau, Alaska Music Matters.
And she is a teacher in the elementary schools there.
Right, that's right.
Now, again, connected to what we're talking about with LAUSD, if I'm not mistaken, there is always the threat in her city to take away music and arts educators in the schools. So you have your own advocacy fight to come back home to.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Final question?
We're public school teachers, and we're involved in an international youth media summit. Last summer in Serbia, we met a marvelous young filmmaker from Canada. And I was wondering if you ladies knew of the documentary from Hemmings House about El Sistema?
What is...
It's a Canadian firm. They did a documentary about El Sistema.
I know about a Canadian documentary, yes.
They're coming to L.A. around the 1st of March. So we're wondering if we can maybe work with Yola to get an audience to the movie. Would you be interested in talking about that?
Sure. Let's find out where you're screening it and let people know. Sure.
Okay, good. Made a date.
Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you so much for being here this evening.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.